Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, YouTube's $4 billion stats brag. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Robert Smith from off of The Cure revealed that he's making an album that is, and I quote, just noise.
Which almost certainly demands a so what's new type response, doesn't it?
Well, I was thinking, is it more now that Robert Smith is old enough that he finds his own music too annoying? He's just like, turn off that noise.
That's almost certainly the obvious gag to go with, I think. Although you didn't in your write-up on this story in the old scene.
No, I thought of it afterwards.
Annoyingly. It wasn't even that you thought of it and decided it was too weak a gag and you rejected it. You just didn't occur to you until we published the story.
No, because everything was in a bit of a rush. And I didn't have time for thinking of jokes. Even obvious jokes.
But we did know, did we already know this, that there are two Cure albums incoming?
Yes, it's not, and this isn't one of them.
That's the key thing, isn't it?
We should stress. He's making an album on his own of just noise, and with The Cure, he's making two other albums. And one of them, he said, was really, really like doom and gloom, and then he said, and the other one isn't. But I mean, is it the exact opposite of doom and gloom, or is it something else? Is it still doom and gloom, but just less so? Who knows?
I'm looking forward to the really cheery, upbeat Cure Europop album. That's surely what that second album's got to be. But the other point worth reminding ourselves is that these two albums, which we're apparently going to get more information on in the next 6 weeks or so, are, I think, they're the first Cure albums in more than a decade. Is that right?
Yeah, their last album, 413 Dream, came out in 2008. So that's well over a decade ago. So yeah, it's probably right that you should be getting two albums at once, or three albums at once. I mean, it sounds like Robert Smith did want this album of instrumental noise to be a Cure album as well, but he said in this interview with Zane Lowe that he did last week that he put that to the band and they just all said no. We're not doing that.
They were kind of like, you can't keep the fans waiting for 12 years or 13 years for a new record and then come back with an album of just noise. Did he? I mean, you say this came from an interview he did with Zane Lowe on the old Apple Music radio station thing. Did he define what he means by noise? I mean, is it white noise? Is it like background noise? Is it building noise? I mean, I have to say, where I live in East London this last couple of weeks, if you wanted an album of relentless drilling, I could have recorded that for you. All I would have to do is turn the recorder on my phone and I could have had well more than 60 minutes of drilling noise. Did he tell us what kind of noise he's working on?
No, a noise is a very broad genre. You could have an album of drilling or electronic noise or kind of ambient music could maybe come under that, certainly if you put distortion on it. And yeah, I don't know. Could be anything. Or, I mean, you know, you could broaden out, as we've already said, to all pop music. So we just don't know. It could be anything.
Yeah, I mean, technically speaking, if we want to be technical about it, it's going to be three albums of noise, isn't it? I mean, unless one of the albums is going to be silence. But I mean, I think the silent album thing's been done, hasn't it? So three albums of noise. Anyway, that was something that happened this week. It's not what we're here to talk about. So what are we going to be talking about in this particular 36 minutes of noise?
Or less.
Or less.
Considerably less recently.
Or more.
It could be a long one. I suspect it's not. Anyway, later on, we're going to be discussing more pleas for the UK government to save the festival season by offering state-backed cancellation insurance. But first, YouTube's global head of music, Leo Cohen, last week published a blog post bragging that the Google video platform has paid out over $4 billion to the music industry over the last year, and that it signed up more premium subscribers in the first quarter of this year than any previous quarter ever. Now, these blog posts putting out these stats from Leo Cohen have been kind of a feature of his time at YouTube, although these days they're perhaps not so much designed as a form of defence against criticism of the video platform.
Yeah, when Leo Cohen joined YouTube, which I think I'm right in saying was 2016, around about then, I guess that was when the music industry's relationship with YouTube, which have always been up and down over the years, but they were very much on a down when Leo Cohen first joined the Google company. It was when the whole safe harbor debate was gaining momentum. It was when the Spotify's of this world were becoming the big revenue generators for the record industry. Apple Music had launched. It was all about premium subscriptions. And then there was this whole narrative that the streaming boom is being powered by selling premium subscriptions, but we're not selling as many premium subscriptions as we would like because of all the free services. But the reason why Spotify has to have a free tier is because of all the free music on YouTube. And although YouTube is licensed and we make some money from YouTube, we don't make enough money from YouTube. And if you divide how much money we make from YouTube by all the videos that are streamed, the music videos, I should say, that are streamed on YouTube, then the per play royalties are tiny compared to what we would get even from Spotify free, let alone Spotify premium. That's a value gap. There's been a transfer of value. These were all the terms being thrown about at the time. And I guess when they hired Leo Cohen, obviously former record industry executive from the American music industry, was with Warner for a time and Universal prior to that. When they hired him, it was kind of positioned as relationships between YouTube and the music industry have really slumped in the last year or so. We need to get one of that side of the room. We need to get somebody who is friends with the music industry on our team to try and build some bridges and mend that relationship. And so, a lot of people saw his hire as being an attempt to try and improve relations between YouTube and the music industry. And as a result of that, yeah, as you say, these semi-regular blog posts that he puts out in the early days, usually either explicitly or implicitly, were responding to whatever YouTube dissing a music industry executive or company or trade organization had been doing in recent months.
Yeah, so despite all those blog posts being put out under Leo Cohen's name, it didn't really seem for a long time like having him on board was really improving things for YouTube. The narrative was kind of, well, instead of hiring someone from the music industry, why don't you just pay the music industry more money and deal with all your problems that way? But over the last few years, the relationship between YouTube and the music industry has got a lot better. And whether that's anything to do with Leo Cohen or not, it's hard to say. But there are various reasons why that relationship's got better. I mean, there's the launch of the standalone YouTube music streaming service, which works more like Spotify and Apple Music, which was quite a key development in that relationship being improved. And it allowed Google to argue that all the free music that's available on the main YouTube platform was directly helping to upsell the premium subscriptions that the record industry prioritizes in streaming. So basically the same argument that Spotify has always used to justify its free tier, although, and perhaps another reason why YouTube is on better terms with the music industry these days, there's been a surge in ad sales on the main YouTube platform over the last couple of years, and a big increase in the number of ads being served alongside videos on its free service. So whereas Spotify's ad-funded platform doesn't really make a huge amount of money for the music industry, YouTube's free service is bringing in more revenue to the music industry.
Yeah, if like me, you watch a lot of content on YouTube, you will almost certainly have noticed. Oh, well, assuming like me, you're honest and you haven't done everything you can to install plugins on your devices so the ads don't roll. So if you're an honest, frequent user of YouTube like me, you can't fail to have noticed just how much more advertising there is on the YouTube platform. And I mean, back in the day, some people in the music industry, I think, were sometimes a little bit cynical that, yes, okay, From very early on, YouTube had deals with the music industry where it agreed to share the ad revenue that it generated around videos, whether those were music videos or user-generated content videos that contained music. It was happy to share that money with the music industry, and actually, at a basic level, the rev share deal that YouTube has with the music industry is not that different to the rev share deal that the streaming services like Spotify and Apple have with the music industry. But I think there used to be a little bit of cynicism that, well, that's all well and good, but YouTube just doesn't sell enough advertising. And when it does sell advertising, it doesn't charge enough for that advertising. So our 55% of that money is not as good as it sounds, because there's not that many ads being sold. They're being sold quite cheaply. You could go even further with a conspiracy theory, which is that Google at large would obviously rather sell advertising on its other services, like its search engine, where it doesn't have to share that money with any content creators. So was it actually using YouTube to build up lots of data about people and to grow its user base so that then it could sell more advertising on Google search, etc.? But yeah, I mean, in the last couple of years, the quantity of ads on YouTube has really increased. Now, we could debate about whether or not that has ruined the consumer experience on YouTube, but it does mean a lot more advertising money is coming in, and where it is music videos being consumed or it's user-generated content that contains music and that's being monetized properly through Content ID, there is ever-increasing amounts of advertising income coming from YouTube, as well as the growth of premium subscriptions with the YouTube Music Service. And of course, there is now a premium product for the entire YouTube platform. And I guess that latter point is interesting from a Leo Cohen perspective, because one of the things that he's always been keen to stress ever since he joined YouTube to his former colleagues in the record industry is, while record companies have been predominantly focused for some time now on selling premium subscriptions, and that being the main way we make money out of streaming, and so we tolerate the free tier of Spotify because it helps Spotify sell more premium subscriptions. And on one level, the record industry is right to be focused on premium subscriptions. If you look at all the money that the record industry made in 2020 worldwide of the streaming revenue stream, which is the biggest revenue stream overall, don't forget, about three quarters of that streaming money came from selling premium subscriptions. And then all of the various different free services made up, you know, just over a quarter of that money. So on one level, the record industry is right to prioritize premium subscriptions. But I think one thing Leo Cohen has always said is, but you're too quick to write off the free services. And actually, there's a lot more opportunities with free services than you think. But those opportunities are probably more on platforms where you have other kinds of content, user-generated content, etc., rather than straight music services like Spotify. And so this is why you should not be as anti-YouTube as the labels were a few years ago. And it has to be said, although this latest stats brag blog post from Leo Cohen wasn't really dealing with direct criticism from the music industry, because there's a lot less, certainly, public criticism of YouTube by the music industry these days. There are not so many press releases put out and statements put out and blog posts written by trade bodies slagging off YouTube. But it's not to say that everyone in the music industry now loves YouTube. There are still plenty of people, particularly on the sort of the songwriter publisher side, who are still quite critical of YouTube. But a lot less public criticism of YouTube, which means that this blog post wasn't having to respond to any recent specific criticism of the YouTube platform and the YouTube business. But nevertheless, the key message of the blog post, aside from sharing these stats, was still, as a music industry, what you should understand, says Leo Cohen, is that there are ad revenue streams and there are subscription revenue streams, and they don't necessarily conflict, they complement each other, and there's still huge opportunities to make way more money on the advertising side.
Yeah, so he said, through our ad-supported free tier in 180 countries and subscription tiers in 96 countries, we give users the choice to pay with their attention or their wallets. YouTube is the world's largest stage, and advertisers are eager to tap into the deep music engagement that the platform enables. With over 2 billion users watching music videos monthly, YouTube allows advertisers to reach audiences they can't find anywhere else. In addition, we added more paid members in the first quarter of 2021 than in any other quarter in our history.
Yeah, so really trying to stress there to the music industry, it's not just about premium subscriptions, it's about the free side too. He talked about YouTube having twin engine growth because they have the free side and the paid for side. And he's basically saying, look at all the money that we can make from selling advertising, but still be selling subscriptions as well. So quarter one of 2021. I mean, it has to be said that the stats brag regarding premium subscriptions, if we want to dissect that, we added more paid members in quarter one of 2021 than any other quarter in our history. I mean,
so four.
Exactly. I mean, that depends how many they were adding in previous quarters. There's a little bit of a suspicious statement there. He wasn't saying we added 500 million paying users in quarter one. But as I say, interesting that he was keen to stress that ad funded can be a significant revenue generator for the music industry. And obviously he would say that YouTube is leading the way in that domain.
Yeah, and a key part of that is that YouTube is also monetizing user-generated content. So he said, of the more than $4 billion generated for artists, songwriters and rights holders in the last 12 months, over 30% has come from UGC. Fan-powered videos have always flourished on YouTube, helping artists to grow their audiences and break songs around the world. We're thrilled it's now also become a meaningful and incremental source of revenue alongside premium music content.
Regular readers of the See Me Daily, who also happen to listen to Set This Podcast, will be pleased to know that when Andy said the word thrilled there, he was saying it in capital letters.
So I can't not.
He didn't shout it, which you might expect when somebody's speaking in capital letters, but it is actually possible to speak in capital letters without increasing your volume, apparently.
Do you want me to do it again?
No. It's all good. And anyway, for me, personally, the most interesting bit of this new blog post from Leo Cohen wasn't any of the stuff we've talked about so far, even though we've talked about it quite at length. It was the final section of this blog post, which I thought was most interesting, when he started talking about how, on top of all of this, all these premium subscriptions and all this ad money that YouTube is generating, not only is YouTube doing all of that for the music industry, it is also finding new sources of revenue. And then he started talking about the various kind of direct-to-fan tools that YouTube now offers. Some have been around for quite some time, some are more new. So we're talking about things like the merch shelf, which means that artists can be selling merchandise and physical releases directly from their YouTube channels. You can do ticket upsells from official artist pages. And then they've got channel memberships now, and you've got the digital gifting stuff that you can do around live streams. And basically, although in the wider scheme of things, the money coming in from those direct-to-fan elements of YouTube are modest compared to the money that's coming in certainly from the ad sales, and I would assume also from the premium subscription sales, I think for me, those direct-to-fan tools are becoming more important. They're becoming an increasingly important part of the mix. And the reason why this interests me is we have just put out another report as part of our partnership with Impala, the Pan-European Trade Organization for the Independent Music Community. You may remember, because I'm sure we've talked about it on Setlist before, because I can't believe
it. Seems like the sort of thing we would discuss at some point.
I'm sure I could not have got this far about plugging this really interesting series of reports and webinars that we are producing and staging in partnership with the Digital Committee of Impala under the header of One Step Ahead. And the latest of those reports we published last week, and that actually is looking at the diversifying digital music market. So actually, it's not just talking about direct-to-fan channels, it's covering some of the stuff we've been talking about already on this edition of the podcast, which basically is this point that, okay, yes, in 2020, three quarters of all streaming money, just under, for the global record industry came from selling premium subscriptions of the Spotify variety. But a lot of the exciting stuff that's happening in digital music is in that other 25%, the other ways that we make money out of digital platforms. And we're starting to see some growth there, obviously on the advertising side and the user-generated content side, as Leo Cohen brags about in his blog post. And it's not just on YouTube, obviously. We've also got Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, etc. And so in this report, we look at what is happening with those other sides to all of these social media and video sharing platforms. But we do also talk about those direct-to-fan tools that are gaining momentum, sometimes on standalone sites like Bandcamp and Patreon, and sometimes within YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitch, etc. Because I think we've always said at CMU that the single biggest impact that digital had on the music industry was the direct-to-fan relationship that digital channels allow. And it has always felt that the music industry at large has never truly capitalised on the potential of the direct-to-fan relationship. Certain artists definitely have, but the industry at large has not. And I suppose up until relatively recently, a lot of direct-to-fan activity, where the artist has a direct relationship with core fan base online, has been about selling physical products to that fan base through various websites. So whether that's physical releases, vinyl, cassettes even, or it's merchandise, and then you set up a store on the artist's website, or you use Bandcamp, or you use Kickstarter, and then you sell physical products. Maybe you do a fan funding campaign, a pre-order campaign, and that's what a lot of direct fan activity has been about. But where we're starting to see the growth, and I think in a way COVID shutdown and the increase in things like live streaming have all contributed to this, is on digital content based direct to fan monetization, where you're starting to charge fans for access to premium content that sits behind a paywall, or priority access to content, all the digital gifting stuff that's happening on a lot of those apps. So that's things like, see if I remember what they're all called. You've got Facebook stars, YouTube super chat, super stickers, TikTok's coins, and the bits on Twitch, all of that stuff that's going on. That's really starting to gain momentum. Okay, and reality check, it's, you know, it's not bringing in billions of dollars yet, but I think we're going to start to see that becoming ever more important in the years ahead as the digital market matures and diversifies. Things like that are going to be ever more important in keeping the digital market growing. And basically what this report is about is going through all the different manifestations of that, what platforms are operating in this space, what the opportunities are, and also looking at it from a label's perspective, because obviously all of this is content driven. Labels are key business partners for artists around content. So what is the label's role, particularly once you get more into that director fan activity, which may be more driven by artist and management traditionally. So that's what the report is about. And that's why the final bit of Leo Cohen's blog was particularly interesting to me, because that's where he started talking up the other ways that YouTube is helping artists monetize what they do.
Yeah, and of course, YouTube's also very keen to snuffle up the emerging live streaming market, getting it away from all the other various big players and also all the startups who are coming into that industry and fighting them all off and taking that whole market for itself. We'll see if that works and if that becomes another thing that Leo Cohen brags about in a future blog post.
Yeah, and I think that is what does make YouTube interesting. And I will stress again, you know, while there are a lot more people in the music industry who speak positively about YouTube today than there was certainly 5 years ago and 2 years ago, or even 1 year ago, there are still plenty of people who have issues with the YouTube model. But I think what is interesting about YouTube is it is a platform which cuts across so many of the digital revenue streams. So it has its subscription streaming service, then all the different ways that music gets used on YouTube, paid for by advertising, YouTube Shorts. Now, whether or not it's a bit late to the party when it comes to having a TikTok type product, I don't know. But obviously that's now rolling out in the US and it will come to Europe very soon as well, I am sure. Then it's got all the live streaming stuff, which it mainly monetizes at the moment with so-called digital gifting, with whatever it's called. The super chat, I get them all confused. It has a digital gifting element to live streaming, but also it is dabbling behind the scenes with ticketed live streaming, and it's done a few pilots in that domain as well. Plus you've got channel memberships, you've got merch upsell, all of these different things going on the YouTube platform. And that's not to say that YouTube is going to become the one-stop everything platform for artists. It's not. There is no one-stop platform for artists. And, you know, a lot of artists have a much more engaged fan base on Instagram than they do on YouTube. So Instagram is also dabbling in this space. Maybe it makes more sense to be doing some of this stuff on Instagram, or maybe TikTok or Twitch, depending on where your fan base is. But it does make YouTube a very interesting business as the digital market slowly diversifies, as things like live streaming and direct-to-fan become an ever more important part of the mix. It is kind of the one company that does it all. And that makes it interesting. And even though you do sometimes sense that one of the main purposes of Leon Cohen's blogs is to drop some big stats and name check his celebrity pals.
Yes. Chuck D in this one.
Chuck D in this one. My friend Chuck D. Former CMU columnist Chuck D. There you go. That's what he should have said. But interesting company, interesting guy. I am actually generally interested to know what he has to say. And therefore, that's why we spent most of this podcast talking about it.
So yeah, an interesting blog post that we will link to from the show notes if you want to go and read it for yourself. Although we should warn you that the blog post itself is a lot shorter than we made it seem in this section of the podcast, because we've managed to say quite a lot more about YouTube than Leah Cohen did. But, you know, you might be able to find something in there that we haven't mentioned. We should have held back the Chuck D name drop, because I think that was probably the last thing left. But it's nicely laid out. Go and have a look at it.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
And finally this week, MPs on the UK Parliament's Culture Select Committee have again called on the government to urgently instigate a state-backed insurance scheme for large-scale events due to take place in the coming months as COVID restrictions lift. Otherwise, they said, the festival industry will face another lost summer. This plea came as the committee published a report based on its inquiry into the future of the music festival sector.
Now, of course, we are starting to approach the 21st of June target date here in England, when the government is hoping that maybe the vast majority of COVID restrictions that are still in place can be deleted, allowing fuller and possibly full capacity shows to return in venues and festivals, etc. Although I kind of feel we're back in one of those periods where with anything COVID related, I'm a bit nervous even talking about it on the podcast, because I can't help thinking that we're going to have a number of announcements coming out quite quickly about COVID-related things in the next couple of weeks that could mean that by the time this podcast goes out, what we're talking about now is already out of date. I don't know.
Yeah, they went through that phase of putting out statements on Sunday evenings, didn't they? I mean, the podcast was all edited and ready to go, and they ruined it.
So do check the CMU Daily to see whether or not everything we're about to talk about is now outdated. But this relates to the thing that we've definitely talked about before on Setlist, which is, although we're still hoping that full capacity shows will be able to return on the 21st of June, I mean, as we record this, I suppose it is worth noting there are some people who fear it could get pushed back another few weeks because of this new variant of the coronavirus, etc., etc. But if we do meet the 21st of June target, then that means that any festivals due to take place in July and August and September can go ahead with minimum COVID restrictions in place, and that's brilliant. But of course, what we've been hearing from the independent music festival community for months now is, even though in theory, we hope lots of these events can go ahead in July, August and September, because really 6 weeks ago now, a couple of months ago now, the promoters of these festivals started incurring the really big costs associated with those festivals. For a lot of independent promoters, the risk that actually COVID restrictions could extend or could return over summer 2021 means that there is still that risk that, although we're hoping these festivals can go ahead, maybe a last minute cancellation would happen. And that's the problem at the moment, because obviously you can't get cancellation insurance on the private commercial insurance market. So these events are uninsured. And we've seen a number, haven't we, of quite significant independent festivals in the last couple of months cancelling their July, August, September 2021 dates, even though it may turn out that they could have gone ahead, because they simply couldn't afford to continue spending money with the risk of having a last-minute cancellation in a year where they're not insured. And so what the live sector in the UK has been calling for a long time now is government-backed insurance to fill that gap, because there's no insurance available in the commercial market, so that these festivals can carry on planning, they can carry on investing, and then if we do hit that 21st of June target, we will have weeks and weeks and weeks of brilliant festivals that we can all go to, and so that bit of our lives returns. But without that insurance, lots of particularly the independently owned festivals won't be happening this summer, even if every COVID restriction has gone, because they couldn't afford to take the risk. And the argument has been, from both the industry and plenty of supporters, as this report confirmed within Parliament, that there was a relatively easy fix to this problem, which was a government-backed insurance scheme, which at the time of recording, we still don't have.
Yeah, and this is really quite a late in the day plea because it's been discussed before that, you know, these massive unrecoupable costs that festivals have to pay out weeks before the event actually takes place are kind of, I mean, the dates for those are passing all the time. And the end of June is probably going to be too late for the vast majority of festivals. But the Culture Select Committee is having another go at getting the government to change its mind. It's not the first time they've done this. And as you say, there have been repeated calls from all across the live music industry for months on this. But the government has resisted all of those calls to date. The only sort of silver lining is that they've indicated that there will likely be some kind of insurance offered once COVID restrictions have actually lifted, but not while those restrictions are still in place. And while there still remains uncertainty about that 21st of June target date, it's just going to be too late for many events. But still in there, plugging away, is the Culture Select Committee Chair, Julian Knight, who said while publishing this report on the festival sector that festivals have been treated as the poor relation by the government during the pandemic. He added that very few festival promoters had benefited from the culture-specific COVID funding that was made available last year, and that festivals would not have featured in the government's events research programme into how to safely get full capacity shows back up and running if the committee hadn't pressed for that too.
Yeah, he then said, it has been made very clear to us that the vast majority of music festivals do not have the financial resilience to cover the cost of another year of late notice cancellations. If the commercial insurance market won't step in, ministers must, and urgently. Events need to know now whether the government will back them or they simply won't take place this year. And therefore, Julian Knight MP continued, we repeat our call for the government to announce an insurance scheme to cover festival organisers if events need to be cancelled as a result of COVID-19 restrictions continuing beyond the 21st of June. There's still time to get the music playing, but no more room for excuses.
Alongside that, Paul Reed, who is the CEO of the Association of Independent Festivals, said that the AIF welcomes the findings of the committee and appreciates its efforts over the past few months. We are pleased that MPs have again echoed our repeated calls for government-backed insurance for festivals. Then, noting that there could be some state-backed insurance after the 21st of June, he went on, we expect swift intervention at that point with an insurance scheme that protects festivals that may need to cancel after the 21st of June. Should the trajectory of the pandemic dictate new lockdown, enforced reduced capacity or social distancing measures? As it will take some time for such a scheme to become operational, it is imperative that it is retroactive so that all festivals scheduled to take place after the 21st of June are protected.
So we will see between now and the 21st of June whether or not the government does finally come forward with some sort of state-backed insurance. If that doesn't happen, we will see what happens once COVID restrictions have lifted, what kind of scheme is being offered, how quickly will it be implemented, who qualifies. And unfortunately, in the meantime, as every week goes by, we are going to see more independent music festivals say, even though we're hopeful that we could take place in August, September this year, we simply can't afford the risk anymore, and therefore we are going to cancel our 2021 dates and push everything back into 2022. So as we say, we would expect there to be a number of announcements about all of this in the next couple of weeks, which might render everything we've just said redundant, but hopefully not. And either way, interesting report from the Culture Select Committee on the plight of music festivals during the pandemic.
I mean, I kind of hope that there is an announcement over the weekend about this that is positive, and it does render everything we've just said redundant. Although we did just talk about the continuing campaign to get that insurance, even as it increasingly looks like a lost cause. But fingers crossed, that insurance scheme is put in place very late in the day. Before this podcast goes out, I would welcome that happening, as I'm sure would everyone in the festival sector. But as we say, it is now very late in the day to be doing that. And if the government are going to do it now, they should really have done it months ago. But hey, that's politics. But that is all we've got time for on this episode of Setlist. Do subscribe to the show and rate and review it, because those things help and they're good for you. You can also email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk, if you've got any questions or comments about this show or any other. I mean, this Setlist specifically, but I listen to a lot of podcasts. I'm happy to discuss podcasts if that's what you want to do. But that's the end of the show. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.